He doesn't even have to do stuff per se. He can just say something and it creates these ripple waves. If Trump is out there saying we're not going to defend Estonia,
that's pretty emboldening, if you ask me.
If it comes to a choice between this, you know, supporting Ukraine or following Trump, they will choose Trump.
So Ukraine aid keeps on being tied to, like, essentially the most controversial issues in American politics.
Yeah.
It's genuinely scary for me as Ukrainian to imagine what the front line is going to look like.
And there's no question about it. Like, it would be catastrophic.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Ukraine, a show where the newsroom of the Kyiv Independent explains Ukraine's biggest events in just under 30 minutes. I'm your host, Anastasia Lopatina. Today, we're talking about Donald Trump's relationship with Russia and Vladimir Putin, and what another 4 years of Trump in the White House might mean for Ukraine. I'm joined by my colleague, Nate Osteler, who is the news editor at the Kyiv Independent. Nate, it's your first time on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
But before we go on, I'll remind you guys to please subscribe to the Kyiv Independent wherever you're listening to this show, whether that's on YouTube or on audio platforms. Leave reviews, like our episodes. Please do tell us what you think about our content. It only takes a second for you, but goes a really long way for us, because that kind of engagement is what helps YouTube algorithms to promote the show, so more people will stay informed about Russia's war in Ukraine. So, Nate, we brought you into the studio virtually today, because the US election campaigning is already in full swing. And Trump is back in the headlines, in the news. And this time it's not about his trials in court. It's actually about some pretty scandalous remarks that he made about Ukraine. So tell us what happened.
I'm guessing you're referring to this thing that Orban, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, said after a meeting with Trump recently, where Trump apparently said he would not give a penny more to Ukraine if he's reelected. And this is kind of the last in a long series of things that are very similar to this that Trump has said. So it's not exactly a new statement that he's opposed to aid to Ukraine, but this is one of the first times that he's so directly articulated it.
You're right. It's no secret that, you know, Trump can be quite inflammatory. He's said a lot of scandalous, inflammatory things in the past. And what some of his supporters will sometimes say is that, you know, he just says it. He doesn't actually mean it. He's not going to act on it. So he'll just talk. So how seriously should we be taking this anti-Ukrainian rhetoric from him?
Well, that is a good point. I mean, anyone who's paid attention to him for the past 10 years that he's been in politics knows that he says lots of crazy things that he doesn't end up following through with. I mean, this is mostly domestically, but also, of course, abroad too. And when it comes to the US, I mean, he doesn't have the ability to unilaterally do everything that he wants to do, even if he actually intended to follow through on these things. So even within his own party, there's not 100% consensus about this idea of abandoning Ukraine. And we don't know, like, assuming that he does get elected, we don't know what the situation will be in Congress if the Republican Party will win the House of Representatives and the Senate, and they have all three, then yeah, there could be a serious problem for sure. So at the end of the day, there are two factors here. There's the Trump's actual track record when it comes to Russia and his kind of personal affinity for strongmen. And there's also the actual situation in government. Who else gets elected, and the ability of the people within his own party and the rest of the government to constrain whatever kind of crazy ideas he follows.
So let's start with the first factor, which is Trump's track record, as you said, with Russia, with the Kremlin, and his personal relationships with dictators all around the world. So what do we know about these relationships?
This alone could be an entire podcast episode, because there's a super long history of this. And it doesn't just include Putin, it doesn't just start when he was president. I mean, this goes back super long way before he was ever a politician. So just to focus on the Russia aspect, he said many, many crazy things, many comments kind of defending Putin, saying that he's a strong leader, that he's brilliant, including some things that are also denigrating Ukraine. criticizing President Zelensky, criticizing other Ukrainian leaders, saying that they're corrupt. And I think it really becomes serious is when he started running for president. And like most things with Trump, this is all kind of, not all, but mostly about himself. There's this famous press conference in 2018 in Helsinki with Trump and Putin. And Trump says that Putin has told us, the US, that the Russia did not hack our elections. And Trump says, goes on to say, like, I believe it.
And that goes against all of the assessments from the US intelligence community, from Trump's own government.
Yes, of course. But I mean, here, I guess to go back to the ego thing, this is from what most people think who study Trump, like the reason that he's so against this idea that Russia interfered in the election is because it kind of devalues his victory. And anything that devalues his victory, like puts into question whether or not he won on his own, that goes against like the entire idea of who he is as a person.
Right. I've seen many reports of, you know, him discussing Russia and the Kremlin. He would often say, maybe not that he is in love with Putin or Russia's politics, but something like, oh, we have a great relationship. They love me. Putin loves me. You know, he has a great impression of me. So it was often centered around him, about Trump himself.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And he says, you know, Putin respects me. And then he compares this to Obama, you know, Putin doesn't respect Obama. And this is always like, it's not about, you know, USA-Russia relations. It's about how do I personally feel when this leader talks to me? And they know this, they know how to talk to him, like how to show him the kind of respect that he thinks he deserves. So there was a theory that was particularly popular back around the 2016 election that took this idea even further, that it wasn't just rhetoric, that Trump was actually somehow connected to Russian intelligence or was actually a spy himself. And so far, there hasn't really been any definitive evidence of this. And someone, not me, of course, someone came up with this saying, like instead of Occam's razor, they said Trump's razor. Like, okay, you could make this crazy explanation that, you know, he's actually a spy. But most of the time, when we're trying to explain this, you know, crazy things that he does, it's just like the stupidest explanation. And it goes back to what we just said, that it's all about personality, you know, flattering his ego, this love for power and so on. I mean, it is not impossible that there could be some ties to Russian intelligence, but I don't think there's anything so far to prove that.
During his time at the White House, Trump has often spoken negatively about big organizations that the US is a part of. So, you know, thinking the UN, NATO, various trade organizations and so on. And while he's known for his anti-NATO rhetoric, he's also been talking about this recently, going as far as to say that because certain members of NATO perhaps don't pay as much into the NATO budget as they should, as much as they've pledged at least, he would actually encourage Russia to basically invade NATO. He said that if NATO members don't pay their fair share, as Trump thinks, he's going to encourage Russia to do whatever the hell they want. And this is when a lot of people started saying that it's getting really dangerous. So it's worth talking now about the second factor that you've outlined. What can actually constrain Trump and what can actually stop him if he is reelected and if he's again in the White House and this anti-NATO, anti-Ukrainian rhetoric persists? What are the roadblocks there that can actually have the checks and the balances in the system so Trump doesn't actually go and pull out of NATO?
That's a really good question. And I guess, I mean, the main answer is like, we have to look at the way that the US government works. And it depends entirely on the makeup of Congress if he is elected, if the Republicans control the Senate and the House. And we can look at his first term to see that, like, even with control over both branches, he actually was not able to do most of the crazy things that he said. And it's also worth keeping in mind that this is not his top priority. I mean, the things that he really wants to do are mostly about domestic politics. So it's hard for me to imagine that, as anti-Ukraine, as anti-NATO as he might be, that's not going to be his first priority if he gets into office. And the domestic fights that probably will happen first will take up a ton of energy before he even gets to the whole, U.S. is leaving NATO.
Sure, of course, there is Congress, there is the Constitution, there are all of these kind of roadblocks in his craziness way. But still, he did a lot of crazy things, thinking of the Muslim ban, which kind of shook the US and the world as well. He pulled out of the Paris Agreement, he pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, he killed an Iranian general. All of those things were pretty outstanding and not in a good way.
Yeah, without a doubt, he did many crazy things, even with the constraints that are built in. And one of the scariest things is that, like, he doesn't even have to do stuff per se. He can just say something and it creates these ripple waves. And that's part of the issue with NATO, is that it's not just like part of this whole Article 5 is about the kind of psychological understanding that we will all come to each other's defense as all NATO members.
Right, and because NATO is a deterrence mechanism. So your enemies have to be scared of you for them to not act, right? To not show aggression. That's the whole point.
Right. I mean, the point would not be for NATO to actually fight Russia, but for Russia to be scared enough of NATO to not fight. So,
right.
Like, if Trump is out there saying we're not going to defend Estonia,
that's pretty emboldening, if you ask me.
Right. It doesn't matter if Estonia is a small country. Like, in NATO, all countries are treated equally. So that's the entire point of Article 5. And it's hugely damaging to even suggest that the US would not respond.
Speaking of things that can limit Trump's power and sway, I guess one thing that we definitely saw in the last months is that even though he hasn't been in the White House for years, still, his party, the Republican Party, actually has an extremely limited amount of power over him, right? Because we see this ongoing debacle with the Ukraine aid in Congress right now. And it's been lasting for months. It has been having huge, disastrous consequences for the Ukrainian frontline because the flow of aid has stopped. And it's also all basically because of Trump, isn't it?
Mostly, yeah. I mean, not entirely, but mostly because of him, I would say. Part of the problem is that, from the beginning, that the U.S.'s involvement in the war has been tied to Biden. I mean, this has become his project. And Republicans are opposed to anything that Biden does. So anything that he's for, they're against.
Even if it's a legitimate issue that they should be supporting.
Totally. And, countless people have said, if the hero of the Republican Party, Reagan, were to see the way that the Republican Party is acting now, he'd be rolling over in his grave, whatever. Probably true. So what happened in Congress is that they realize that this is Biden's issue and they don't want to give him a win, the Republicans. So they're throwing all these things in the way to try and extract some concessions. And, there is legitimate concern about the border, but there's no reason that Congress can't deal with the border and give money to Ukraine at the same time. They've framed it in this way that it has to be one or the other, that they can't give money to Ukraine until the border is fixed, as if this is not an issue that there hasn't been an answer in decades. It's crazy to think that we're going to come up with a sudden solution in 2 months. So,
but as much as I'm not a huge Biden fan either, I'm not, pledging my deep loyalty here, but the Democrats did propose a bill to fix the border, which, as far as my understanding of the bill goes, it's a pretty comprehensive bill and both parties have worked on it. And it's, the most radical solution. It's the biggest kind of win for the Republicans that they've had in terms of border security in many, many years. And they've still rejected it. And so they've rejected the solution to the border crisis, which also means they've rejected the bill to pass funding for Ukraine because those are tied. And that's because of Trump, because Trump doesn't want Biden to have a win before the election, even though it seems to be a genuinely good bill. At least it's the best bill that they've seen in years.
Exactly. I mean, he said pretty much explicitly, like, don't pass this bill because I want to run on this border issue in the general election. And and this is even risky for Democrats because, like, the bill is not super popular with the Democratic electorate and it could cost them some votes too. But it doesn't matter because, like, at the end of the day, even these Republicans who are in favor of aid for Ukraine, like, if it comes to a choice between this, supporting Ukraine or following Trump, they will choose Trump.
That actually leads perfectly into my next question. Do we have any fresh numbers on how Americans in general and also the Republican Party specifically, how are they feeling about Ukraine? How many want to support Ukraine, keep funding Ukraine's efforts?
Yeah. So there's been some recent polling and the numbers have definitely slipped. So there's a poll by Pew in December that said that only 47% of Americans think the level of support is just right or not enough. And another 31% said it's too much. In comparison, you have 48% of Republicans who say that it's too much. And that number for Democrats is only 16%. And then there's another poll in February by Marist that said 34% across the board is sending too much money. And 56% of Republicans think U.S. is sending too much money. But you have some kind of contradictory polling as well. Like if you ask a different question. So this is a Pew poll in February. And 75% of Americans still think that this war is super important to them. But the problem here is like how important compared to other issues. And that's the kind of key. So when they ask these lists of like which issues are most important to you, Ukraine is almost never in the top tier.
Let's still look at some more polling that's pretty important, and that's actual polling of support for Trump and Biden. Because what I'm interested in is what are the chances of Trump actually being reelected and everything that we've just discussed becoming a real big problem for Ukraine going forward?
You know, that's like the million-dollar question, of course, and like impossible to say. I mean, we can look at polls now that will show roughly Trump is slightly ahead by 1 or 2 points, but it goes back and forth. And it's, you know, it's so far from the general election in November that it's really hard to say that this will be reflected then. I mean, if you look at, let's say, this same time, March 2020, Biden was roughly ahead by a wider margin than Trump is now, and he went on to win. But that wasn't true in 2016. So it's very difficult to say.
But we do know that Biden is having some really serious issues with his electability. And he's very actively losing voters over a variety of issues, including his support for Israel, including his age and so on. So the prospects are not extremely hopeful, to put it that way.
Well, yeah, that's putting it nicely. Like, you know, problem number one is like he's not getting any younger. And
yeah.
There's nothing he can do about that. And as you said, the Israel issue is big. And that even cost, you know, this last Senate bill that had aid for Israel and Ukraine lost the votes of two Democratic senators plus Bernie Sanders. And they said that was because it included money for Israel.
So Ukraine aid keeps on being tied to like essentially the most controversial issues in American politics as of recently. Support for Israel, the border. I mean, it couldn't get any worse if we're looking at it strictly from a Ukrainian perspective.
Yeah. And it's really unfair because like they could just make a standalone bill with aid for Ukraine
and move on.
But then, yes, of course. But then they would say, like, why are you doing this and not something else? So
I mean, it's hard to even begin to imagine how disastrous things are gonna be if the U.S. just actually completely stops supporting Ukraine. If the flow of money just stops. We just recently saw what happened in Avdiivka, and we've made a whole podcast episode and various videos on our YouTube channel about the Ukrainian withdrawal from Avdiivka. And the government kept saying that it was largely influenced by the fact that there is a drop in Western support, in American support. We don't have enough ammunition and so on. So if you multiply that, you know, by 1,000 and you imagine that a year goes on and we don't have any American money and no American weapons, it's genuinely scary for me as Ukrainian to imagine what the front line is going to look like.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question about it. Like, it would be catastrophic. And basically everyone, I mean, there's a widespread consensus among leaders in the West that this is true. I mean, Senator Schumer said this in Lviv in a recent visit, that basically without US aid, Ukraine will lose the war. And that's kind of the way it stands right now. And I mean, I could see a situation in which Ukraine would be forced into a very unfair peace deal.
Which will likely only mean a temporary peace, because as many military experts, Russia experts have said, you know, any pause in fighting only benefits Russia and they can regain the initiative. They can even pause for years like it's been with Chechnya and then come back only stronger. We're now going to be moving to the community question of today's episode. As always, I'll remind you guys to go to communindependent.com/membership to donate, support us, support our work so we can keep doing what we do. You get really cool perks for becoming a member of our community, like exclusive access to discussions with editors, various events, and so on. Nate has been on one of those discussions recently as well. And our favorite perk is, of course, that you get to send us in questions before every single episode of the podcast. And we try to incorporate as many of them as we can. So the community question that we're going to be addressing today is there any possibility that Ukraine's allies around the world, like Europe, could supply enough military weapons and munitions to Ukraine to allow Ukraine to succeed in the war? And that's within the context of, like, if US stops supporting Ukraine. The question is basically, I guess, the question that everyone has been asking as of recently. Can Europe do it without the US?
Right. So basically, no. I mean, that's the answer. That's what Zelensky said, that basically no. Foreign Minister Kuleba said there is no plan B. And the Kiel Institute for the World Economy think tank said basically that Europe would need to double its current level of assistance in order to match the deficit from the US.
Which I feel like is extremely unrealistic.
Super unrealistic, especially given the way that Europe has gone about it so far. I mean, the sad thing is, like, if you asked me this question in 2014, the answer could be yes. Like, if you had 8 years of Europe actually preparing and taking Russia seriously, then yeah, probably they could match the military equipment output. But they're not doing it now, and even the full-scale war, for whatever reason, hasn't been enough to kind of light the fire. So I guess I would want to add, like, one kind of devil's advocate suggestion, which is not really coming from me, but coming from some in Europe, that these kind of crazy things about the US leaving NATO and Trump not willing to defend certain countries, like, to a certain extent, this has been the kind of fire that some of these countries needed. I mean, you have Estonia's Prime Minister Kaja Kallas said that it was a wake-up call, that Europe really hasn't done enough. And maybe they wouldn't have gotten this message with the kind of nice way that Biden or Obama has said this. I mean, of course, I'm not saying that, like, I approve of Trump saying he won't defend NATO, but perhaps there's a need for this kind of extreme
more independence threats among European nations and Europe as a whole.
Right. So the kind of takeaway of this is that regardless of who wins the election, the US is not super reliable as an ally, and we can see that now. So if that's what it takes to show Europe that they need to kind of get their act together, then unfortunately, like, that is what it is. Just like a kind of brief snippet that's not all doom and gloom. It does seem like the Ukrainian government has a plan in mind if Trump is elected.
What kind of plan?
Well, we don't know exactly, but Foreign Minister Kuleba said like he is someone that we can work with. And they are largely like refraining from openly criticizing him.
Of course. I mean, it's not in our interest to anger anybody from the US.
Totally. But it does seem like, you know, as we all know about Trump, about, and we've talked about already, that he's, you know, prone to flattery. And there is a way that, you know, they could maybe convince Trump that this is his fight and he could be remembered as the one who helped Ukraine compared to Biden and so on.
And especially compared to Obama, who did close to nothing in 2014 when Russia first invaded Ukraine.
Exactly. And, you know, he loves, I mean, Obama is probably like number one enemy. So
yeah,
he can do anything to say like, I did this better than Obama. That helps.
So we might see some interesting talking points from the Ukrainian government soon.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on it, but it's not impossible to think that, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that Trump doesn't follow through on what he says. So,
well, Nate, thank you so much. It was really interesting to listen to you.
Thanks for having me. It was great to be here.
You can find our show on YouTube and all audio platforms every Saturday. If you like this episode, please subscribe to us and like our content wherever you're listening to this show. Go to giveindependent.com/membership to become a member of our community and support our work. And also follow us on social media on X, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be back next week. Thank you for listening.